This is Spectrum.
Alternative medicine, homeopathy, secret society, hypnosis, the paranormal, alternative energy, UFO abduction, the weird, the wild, and the wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan, here with my co-host, Tom Theophanis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Hey, Scott, how you doing?
Got a great guest this week. I know who it is. It's Dr. Yes. Cokejohn, yeah. Tyler Cokejohn. He'll be talking about Alzheimer's, so yes, this should be interesting. Can you tell me a bit about him?
Yeah, he has a PhD in biochemistry from Loyola University in Chicago, and he's a professor of microbiology at the Arizona College of Osteopathic Medicine. He's also an adjunct senior scientist at the Bonner Sun Health Research Institute, working as a team member researching Alzheimer's disease, the biochemistry and the effects of immunotherapy on AD pathology and dementia. And as we mentioned before, he was a past guest with Carol Rainey. So welcome, Tyler Cokejohn.
How are you? Thank you, Tom, and hello, Scott.
Hi, Dr. Cokejohn. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Glad to be here.
Okay, I wanted to... Now, this is a subject that's close to my heart because my mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. I believe dementia is an aspect of that. A couple of years ago, and it's been a slow, it's been a slow process of degradation. I'm going to be listening closely to everything you have to say, and it's important to me and my family. So maybe we should start out with a brief history of Alzheimer's, as well as a history of how you got involved and what your foundation is looking into.
Sure. Alzheimer's disease has been described formally for over 100 years. And physician Alois Alzheimer described a patient at that time that we would now recognize as the rarest form of the disease, the presenile dementia, early onset, familial or genetic form of the disease. And what he did is describe the basic pathology, the changes in the brain that we now recognize are correlated with the finding of dementia, Alzheimer's disease. These are amyloid plaques, just big lumps of small little proteins that accumulate, very insoluble, very difficult to even examine, and it clogs the vessels of the brain, this amyloid. In addition, there are other pathological changes within the neurons themselves, the key cells needed for signaling and cognition, we call tangles, and this is a protein that's often associated with microtubules that just gets twisted up into giant in terrifically insoluble masses inside the cell, ultimately is lethal. This pathology was well described, had been seen, but the biochemistry has really exploded in the last 20 years. We've made just tremendous strides understanding the fundamentals of how these structures are put together and how they actually are induced in the brain.
Okay.
And we've had the genes that lead to Alzheimer's disease, many of them have been cloned and analyzed. The proteins are known at the molecular level. We have now figured out key mutations in the amyloid protein itself or in the precursor. There's a larger precursor that's cut into the small peptides that accumulate. And just the last, like I say, 25 years, Dennis Selko, Colin McMaster, from Australia, have unraveled this, a lot of the mysteries. And we're trying now to take some of the fundamental biochemical knowledge that's been gathered and put it into clinical use. And it's been a very frustrating process. I've been involved with Alzheimer's disease for 14 years.
Okay.
And I was telling Tom that... communicating with Tom about my experience, and I'm telling you, around 1999, people really thought we had turned the corner. Mm-hmm. It looks so good. We had data with transgenic mice. In Toronto, there's the Center for Neurological Disease Research. Paul Fraser is its director, Dr. Paul Fraser. And we have some very good colleagues there. The mice that people like Dr. Fraser and others have developed were used in studies where the Alzheimer's-like syndrome that we could create in these mice was alleviated. It was remarkable. I mean, people were ecstatic. That,
okay, so it looked like a cure.
It did. It did. And it was so exciting that we really, not we, but companies like, it was Athena Biosciences, now it's Elon, out of Ireland, I think, is where their home base is. They have pushed forward studies in human patients. And 10 years ago, I think everybody really, really thought, this is the way science should go. You know, you put the molecular tools to the problem, you find out what the basis is, and you attack these molecules like amyloid, and the cure will follow. And I'm going to tell you that it's just been, like I was telling Tom, it's been the agony and the ecstasy that we went from this incredible feeling of we got it to, oh, my Lord, what happened?
Yeah, well, and what was the agony part?
Well, when we went ahead and looked at the mice, they were so promising, and we did. The first studies were active vaccinations of people. Just like you would take a flu vaccine, we took that toxic protein and used it to make a vaccine. And these people made antibodies, and the plaques, the big glops of amyloid in the brain, on postmortem examination over the years, it appears that we were able to disrupt those plaques. For years, the prevailing theory still is that, called the amyloid cascade hypothesis, that people make these amyloid proteins in older age, they begin to settle out, crystallize, lump together, and that causes the senile plaques that we see of Alzheimer's disease.
Okay.
On postmortem examination, those plaques melted away. It's stunning, a stunning result. But the patients descended into dementia nonetheless. In addition, the first studies had to be terminated very swiftly because of an unforeseen adverse event, a very, very nasty reactive encephalitis, a swelling of the brain. And so it worked so well in these mice, and it just really has been disappointing in terms of making people not be demented. So we have, right now in the field, we're in a major funk. We're trying to figure out how much of the amyloid cascade hypothesis really works, how much it is correct.
And yeah, how much of it was true, yeah.
And how much of it really in terms of, you know, we see that we have a strong correlation between seeing amyloid plaques in the brain and dementia, but a correlation is not cause. And my gosh, we'd hate to have gone all this way and find out that, whoa, that was really misguided. Personally, my own take on it is that amyloid is central. It does things. It is toxic. There's no question. You don't want big burdens of this in your brain. But, you know, what are we going to do about it is really unclear now.
Can you give us, like, what is the difference between dementia, like, as a separate thing and Alzheimer's, or what is the correlation between the two?
Well, what we see is when people get what we would call dementia, senile dementia, or even earlier, there are cases, fairly rare, but cases where in families it runs very early. And those are usually specific mutations. These people will typically accumulate large amounts of amyloid. We'll see the senile plaques, we'll see tangles, and other classic things that we know are associated with Alzheimer's disease. But if you think about the situation, that diagnosis, the neuropathological diagnosis, is only done on autopsy. So during the time of life, when somebody comes with dementia, it means that they're having cognitive failure. of some sort or another. Confusion, can't remember things, get lost easily. And so we see a malfunction. 80% of the time, it is probably correlated, or actually the numbers bear this out. On autopsy, we see, yeah, okay, we see the Alzheimer's pathology. But there are other things that can cause dementia as well. Vascular disease, stroke, for example.
Right.
Do you remember Senator Pete Domenici from New Mexico? He had to retire a couple of years ago. His problem has been diagnosed as a type of dementia they call frontotemporal dementia.
Right.
It's distinct from Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
It's a tangle-like thing and is in a slightly different region of the brain. In fact, it's higher order function, executive function for him. But anyway, the Alzheimer's, the dementia is more of a functional finding, a clinical finding. The Alzheimer's disease diagnosis is actually made formally on a postmortem basis by a pathologist who totes up the number of plaques and tangles and said, yes, this falls within the generally accepted criteria. And there's a number or an organization we all follow called CERAG, and that was basically an Alzheimer's disease registry. So we'd all be talking about the same thing. But it turns out that it is not simple to make the diagnosis of Alzheimer's, nor do you necessarily hit it accurately all the time. It's kind of interesting. Now when you go back to some of the trials, for example, the first trials with vaccinations, you immediately see one of the problems is that if you look at the patients and you shape them up and say, okay, you're demented, you're only going to be correct that it's Alzheimer's disease 80% of the time. If you have a treatment like Aricept that gives benefit 30% above baseline or something, you're in a pickle because some of your diagnoses are wrong. They're gonna confound you before you even get going. So this becomes an immensely difficult problem. Just saying, okay, that's dementia. You know, what do you have to work with? How do you work with it?
Nothing simple. When a patient goes to a psychiatrist or a psychologist and they're diagnosed with dementia, what is the doctor basing that on?
Oh, okay. They have a battery of tests. What we will do, actually, when we study the biochemistry of the patient, for example, we'll go back to the clinical data, and one of the things they'll do is give them, it's called MMSE, mini mental status exam, and it's a series of questions and exercises. And so you give them, say, five names or objects, five animals to remember, and you talk to them for a while. And then in 4 or 5 minutes, you come back and say, how many of those animal names can you remember now? And you get a number and you get a score. And, you know, you start at something like 32, 33, and you kind of work on down. By the time you get to a score of, say, 17, the patient's in pretty bad shape. But it's exercises that basically anybody should be able to do. But as cognition begins to fail, you find that they're less and less able to comply. So one of the little tricks is count backwards from 100 by sevens. So 93, 86, 79. But not too many people are practiced at that. And you kind of have to think a little bit and do the math, and that's exactly what they want.
My mother would have failed that miserably.
Yeah, me too. And that's why the battery, it's a battery of tests. And so you come after it several different ways. And the other thing is that if the patient's depressed, you know, I don't want to play. You know, I don't care, whatever. It's really hard to figure out where they are. Is it, you know, could you help them just with antidepressant medications, for example? This is where it takes a little time. The neurologist has to work with them it's not an easy diagnosis. It's not simple. Family members can be very important, you know, because they can tell the doctor, you know, he used to be great at cards.
Yeah.
And now he won't play anymore. And that might be a sign, you know, like you take the cards out and start talking about, you know, what's this? Is that, you know, clubs, hearts, I'm so bad, and let them kind of fill in and get a feel for where they are. It's a behavioral assessment, and consequently, it is not trivial.
Now, would you say that, I'm just sorry, but I have a quick one. Would you say that the number of Alzheimer cases and dementia cases are increasing, or is it pretty steady?
I'm going to tell you honestly, Scott, you should always consider the source. What's new about a researcher trying to drum up more funds? But let me tell you, my honest assessment is that we face a demographic crisis looming with Alzheimer's. The rates are increasing, and they are projected to double in the next 20 years. And by 2050, again, my familiarity is most with the United States, we don't have the resources to cover the number of patients, the kind of care that these people need. It's a time bomb, like a barreling down on us like a freight train. Okay. We're in trouble. We really are, because we know that one of the problems is we're victims of our own success. As we have increased the average life expectancy, one of the greatest risk factors for Alzheimer's disease is age.
Right.
And we are definitely coming to a convergence of bad trends. So something's got to be done. There is a real sense of urgency.
What about a lifestyle? Now, we've heard what the technical description of Alzheimer's is. What about the lifestyle causes of Alzheimer's? Is there anything, we could talk about, you know, the stuff that's in our air that wasn't there before, all the electrical signals flying through the air that weren't around 100 years ago, or, you know, lifestyle. We don't really have to work as we're not out in the field, you know, plowing all day long, you know, getting a lot of exercise. We're driving everywhere instead of walking. Is this a factor, do you think, or even our eating habits?
Absolutely. Everything you hit is a factor, and there have been large-scale studies where people who have received a formal diagnosis of Alzheimer's have had their lifestyles, their diets, work history, all these things examined. And what we find are a number of factors leap out at us. One of the key things is cardiac health, absolutely essential. That as people have had more atherosclerosis, more cardiac disease, more vascular disease, we see that that is correlated with a higher risk for Alzheimer's. So we talk about risk factors. We can't talk about absolute issues. Diabetes is terrifically problematic for Alzheimer's disease and other issues of circulation. The other thing is, as you said before, sedentary lifestyle. One thing that's quite interesting is a thing that we'll just refer to as cognitive reserve, which means that people who tend to stay socially engaged or intellectually engaged. So you read the New York Times, for example, and if you're like me, you get very angry and you fire off a righteous letter to the editor. Okay. That kind of keeps you going. You have to have connections, social, intellectual, whatnot. People that do that tend to fare better longer. But everything, as you said, we don't have to struggle for existence in America. I live in Phoenix. This is the place of the car, and people drive everywhere, and they're upset if they have to walk a distance in the shopping mall. I mean, it's not like inconvenience. They're upset, and I shouldn't have to walk. Not everybody
here.
Yeah, but these things I work at a computer all day, and I just don't get the kind of exercise I did when I was a kid. All these things, every one of them are conspiring. More fearsome are things like you mentioned that have been less well explored. Radiation, what are those effects? One of the things that we kicked around in our group, I work with Dr. Alex Roher. He's the lead scientist in our group.
Okay.
Alex has always been convinced that pesticides, among other things, the higher doses, of course, being more problematic, he's always thought that they had a significant neurologic sort of threat to them.
And not only that, but just that in addition to that, the genetic manipulation of the food supply.
And if you think about it, we were talking a little bit earlier, high fructose corn syrup, for example, as opposed to cane sugar. And all of us, I'd say 90% of my diet is something that's processed or prepared by somebody else, not me.
Yeah.
And generations ago, that wasn't the way that it was. And
right.
These things all take a toll. Every day is a different story. And one of the things that's quite interesting is that all these experiments are done on us. I hate to say that, well, okay, it sounds very paranoid, but we do things like unleash DDT in the environment, finding out later that, oh, my gosh, it's in us. It's still in us.
There's video of that you mentioned that. There's video of a truck going down the main street in a small community spraying DDT.
Yeah. Yeah.
At the people. Like, they're going through the middle of downtown. They're not, like, out on a farmer's field spraying it. They were going through downtown spraying this stuff. I was like, whoa, that's an experiment.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, it's still used in, I think they were talking about bringing it back to fight malaria upsurges. You spray houses in some part of the world to try to knock down the mosquitoes that like to feed on humans. But, it, you know, it's one of those things that DDT was engineered and was successfully so to be persistent. We just maybe didn't quite realize what we're getting in the bargain.
Right.
But I joke with my students, you know, that, well, the experiment's in progress and you're it. So it's, you know, this is the world in which
the experiment
actually,
is. Yeah, I agree.
One thing I was going to mention was that recently there was a story up here talking about Agent Orange, but, you know, the one that was used back in Vietnam. And supposedly, you know, it was outlawed, I think, in the early 70s or thereabouts. Apparently, it was being used here for some deforestation-type things that they were doing. They were trying to get rid of some plants or bugs or whatever. And up until 89 or 90. And this was supposed to have been out of circulation.
Yeah.
And those kind of chemicals, you know, what kind of effect, and as a matter of fact, there's one gentleman that had come, you know, and talked to the papers, and he was doing it right in the city. You know, he was using Agent Orange, and I thought Agent Orange was like one of these real bad chemicals, you know, that they had done away with.
Yeah, it's one of the things that's interesting is that, again, I don't know the particulars of this particular case, but a lot of times when things are banned or halted, their use is halted, they still grandfather in existing stocks, you know, that you draw down or use up or whatever. And one of the things that we use a lot of down here is stuff against termites. And, of course, the best stuff was banned 30 years ago. And so we constantly fight the termites down here in Arizona. They're very aggressive. You'd think there wouldn't be anything in the desert. Boy, they found a great home here. But yeah, the I would imagine that probably after, I forget what the original stuff was banned, it probably let the applicators and people use it for quite a while. It's a little shocking to hear that it's still 1989, or maybe later, that Agent Orange was still being used in Canada, but you know, I don't doubt the story that somebody could have a stockman hold on to it. Some of those things do last a long time.
Okay, so with the Alzheimer's research, you talked about one thing that was that looked like it was, you know, the gift to curing the problem, and then it all went down that hill from there. But I'm sure you guys got. You got quite a bit of information out of that. I mean, it still supplied information, even if it didn't cure the problem.
And those trials are still ongoing. What we've done is we have not done the active vaccinations. That had a side effect. And to avoid that, we're just perfusing people with, they call it a humanized monoclonal antibody. It's manufactured, to hit the right target, but won't induce the same kind of bodily reactions that are a real active vaccination where you produce the thing that you
which
know.
Which is what was the swelling of the brain problem.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, maybe this, it'll cure your Alzheimer's, but your brain will blow.
In a hurry.
Yeah.
So one problem down But a lot of the vaccine studies, there's a one that has been out for a while called bapineuzumab is the name of the monoclonal antibody. We're still getting data. In fact, we're looking forward to seeing that at the International Congress of Alzheimer's Disease, what the status of some of these studies are. But yes, they're tracked, examined. We, in our lab, we got some of the people, and remember, they're largely elderly, so it's not unexpected that they will expire over the course of a few years. And as that's happened, we've gotten brain samples, and we've looked at them. That's how we knew that all the indications were it worked. It was a stunning victory against the senile plaque. What we can't say is that it was so great against the dementia. However, knowing that we can get rid of the plaque by these methods, we can now go and say, well, all right, maybe we need to get more concerned about these tangles, and we could perhaps have a combined therapy. The other thing is that going back and doing the postmortem on the study, one possibility is that when patients start to show the first signs of cognitive malfunction, in terms of amyloid, it's probably too late. We think this is a decades-long process, and so maybe we need to start earlier. Maybe we need to do some prospective studies, and there are ways around that. I mentioned before there are familial forms of Alzheimer's disease known. There are families who basically have the curse of 50% chance of dying by age 50 of a really aggressive type of Alzheimer's. It's possible to do a genetic analysis on these individuals who are at risk and identify who does really carry the bad gene and offer them therapy in advance of the issues and problems in a prospective basis and study that.
That would be interesting.
Well, the one that's really fascinating is that there's a gene, I think it's a presenilin gene, that's gone wrong in Medellin, Colombia. They got fixed in the local community, and there are lots and lots of people who basically have high risk of presenile dementia, early onset Alzheimer's disease on the basis of genetic mutation. And those people are being looked at now, large-scale studies, and they may actually be the site of some very important prospective studies coming up soon. So we may be able to get around the, you know, we didn't start soon enough question. In addition, there are other compounds that have been invented to prevent the formation of amyloid outright. And again, those look pretty promising in mice that mimic Alzheimer's disease. They just haven't panned out for us so well in the clinics.
Yeah,
so
I see that.
It's everything, so it looks so good, but the simple answer is not going to work in Alzheimer's. It just isn't, and we're going to have to dig a little deeper.
I had my father has dementia as well, and a couple of years back, we found that he had cancer in the colon, and you know, they operated on him. During the time that he was in the hospital, of course, you know, given whatever drugs they gave him at the time, it kind of brought the dementia much to the front. And you know, there was a lot of upheaval during the period that he was at the hospital. At the time, I approached his doctor, who had you know, mentioned that you know, that he had some mild form of dementia diagnosis, and I asked him, you know, how did he come to that conclusion? And you know, he said based on whatever test that he had performed, not you know, maybe cognitive test, but not like any X-rays or anything like that. And I asked him what may be the cause, at least for him, you know, to have developed it, you know, much stronger at this particular time. And he didn't really have an answer, so me and my sister did some research. And one of the things that I read was that if an individual has a mild form of a stroke, the front lobe can cause this damage to the front lobe, and you know, dementia gets developed from that as well. Is that a correct statement?
It is. It is. And one of the things that the neurologists will do at our institution is try to sort out patients who clearly have some kind of vascular issue, not Alzheimer's disease, things related to stroke. There are several different types of vascular problems you can have. Try to sort them out from what we would call pure, uncomplicated Alzheimer's disease, because it makes our life a lot easier when we try to correlate what went on. But absolutely, you're correct. And the stress alone of hospitalization, there are lots and lots of anecdotal stories. Now, I know a lot of scientists get very nervous about anecdotal stories, but they can be informative.
Oh, yeah.
And so you hear things about this woman was fine, and then she broke her hip, and that was the end. But those kind of severe stress events, all that, can, in fact, induce problems such as you described. So it doesn't surprise me at all to hear that hospitalization induced greater problems.
Well, I mean, the body isn't just parts. You know, all the parts affect everything. You know, it's a whole unit. So one thing can affect another thing. I think specialists, there's a joke about specialists are becoming so specialized that one day they'll know absolutely everything about absolutely nothing. they tend to forget that the whole body is connected, and you can have these sort of effects, and that would probably lead into what you just said as far as anecdotal information.
Absolutely. We're going to have to make you dean of our school, Scott, because that's the osteopathic philosophy, is that you need to be holistic to give the best possible treatment for your patients. That we have lots of our students become specialists in standard medical subspecialties, but one of the things that osteopathic is about is examining the whole issue. And one of the things that was interesting when I was a student at Loyola was they found out that patients who fared the best in a hospital like Loyola University Medical Center, which is a tertiary care facility that had more complex patients, patients that did the best had a general practitioner or somebody watching over them and making sure the specialists talked to each other rather than read the chart, do the medication. Okay, kidneys are fine, but he's screwing up the cardiac system, but he didn't look that far into the chart.
Right.
The patients that had an advocate like that who had the big picture in mind, they fared so much better, so much better. They were actually, I think, this is 25 years ago, they were talking about having patient advocate positions, that physicians who would just simply follow overall what was going on. But yeah, this is, again, a philosophical thing, but Alex Roher, the lead scientist in our group, is a physician. He's an MD.
Okay.
And one of his big insights is that, look, it's more than the brain. And one of the things that we've examined very carefully is the circulatory system aspect, cardiac function, atherosclerosis in the periphery. How does that relate? And we did some studies where we took the arteries at the base of the brain and looked to see how badly damaged they were by basically just vascular disease. Probably most of us have it. It's just a consequence of our Western diet. And what we found was a great correlation between badly damaged, it's called the circle of Willis, kind of forms a little circle at the base of the brain.
Okay.
Bad vessels or vasculature arteries in the circle of Willis correlates to a much higher probability of that patient having had Alzheimer's disease. And so we feel that, you cannot just look at the brain and think that you got the whole story here. And indeed, we would love to do that. This is our tendency, to reduce it down to a pill, reduce it down to a shot. And, okay, yeah, we're going to take care of that amyloid and you're done. Well, it's not going to work that way. And now we're really, really doing some soul searching about what comes next. What do we do? And going back to your question, one of the ways to get to that is to do very detailed analyses of what data we had, what did we see, how did this fare, what happened.
And that includes looking at the demographic, geographically, where do these cases live in the world? Are they, what are their eating habits? Why is it, people that live in this area of the world who live off yogurt and goat's milk live to 110 and never have a sign of senility? It's a much grander thing, isn't it?
It really is, and those things, diet and lifestyle, definitely loom large. The Western diet has some advantages, but you can see that maybe in the long term it has some problems as well. I encountered a person at a meeting one time who was interested in compounds, spice-like compounds called curcumin. And this is actually at UCLA, and they studied these in mice. And
okay.
Those things could actually alleviate the amyloid pathology in the mouse models. Very interesting. And so what they wanted to do is go a little bit too fast, in my opinion. They wanted to basically sell curcumin pills as something you could take.
And what is curcumin? Is that a spice, did you say?
Yeah, it's a curry-like.
I know what cumin is.
Yeah, cumin.
I have some in my...
C-U-R-C-U-M-I-N, I think it was.
Cumin. Yeah, it's an Eastern spice. Yeah,
yeah, and it's something that they put in curry food. And he said that he studied it, this guy apparently anecdotally, in India. And he said that where he had been, I don't know what, I didn't see the particulars of his study, that these people don't get Alzheimer's disease. But that's complex because we don't know the demographics, as you mentioned.
Yeah, well, we don't know whether it's just cumin or they're just their lifestyle or something else.
Yeah, or they may be expiring before it shows up. But the animal model studies were very interesting. I mean, it worked. Problem is, a lot of things work in the mouse models, and they just
like
don't come to
like you said previously. A lot of things work in the animal studies. You put it over to humans, and their brain explodes.
Yes, and so. The other thing is that these guys were ready to sell the pills. That's really what his angle was.
Now I guess if he's doing it in a pure raw spice form, then I would say that's semi-harmless because you could just go eat an Indian dish with cumin on it and have the same effect, right?
Exactly.
But if they're altering it at a chemical level, then I would be a little suspect.
Yeah, and this is legal. In the States, if it's a nutraceutical and they make no claims, they have wide latitude.
Yeah.
And, you know, as long as you're not allergic to it or whatnot, probably be okay. Don't know if you're really helping anything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as far as Codex Alimentarius coming out, you're not going to have that sort of latitude for much longer.
Well,
and vitamin C is going to be against the law, folks, just so you know.
Pretty soon, yeah.
No taking vitamin C against the law.
Well, we're sorry, but we got to take a quick break right now, and we'll see you guys on the other side.
AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com is your gateway to over 500 products, ranging from herbs to pain relief products, health, and well-being. AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com is dedicated to educating and empowering you to make the best possible informed decisions about what products you can use to improve your health and well-being. Visit AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com and bring about change in your life.
Hello, this is Scott Jordan, and I would personally like to thank all of our listeners for their emails of encouragement. It means a great deal to us. All of Spectrum shows are available in two formats, an MP3 stream you can listen to on our site, as well as a YouTube version. All of Spectrum shows are full length and free to listen to, and if I have my way, always will be. Tom and myself do all this work out of pocket, and freely give our time and effort to giving you, the listener, the best, most informative experience possible. I would also like to thank our listeners who have donated in the past to help with our expenses. Every donation goes directly to keeping the project alive. Thank you, enjoy, and keep listening.
Hey If you suffer or know someone that suffers from back pain, knee pain, or any other chronic or sports-related pains, you need to visit LapingoProducts.com. Dealing with pain can affect every aspect of your life, which is why our products are designed to bring you real relief. Our products are not only easy to use, effective, and safe for the entire family, but our prices are competitive and offer a complete satisfaction guarantee. Visit LapingoProducts.com, real life solutions for pain-free living.
You know, the biggest problem I have with this type of disease, and I think that's a problem with, you know, that will become on a worldwide scale in many countries to be able to handle the expense, is to, you know, how do you look after, you know, a large population that has these kind of problems. Right now here in Canada, it seems to me, at least based on my experience, is that the government doesn't really want to do a whole lot to deal with individuals that have these problems, and they push it back on to their caregivers and their families, you know. And you know, how do we deal with that in the future if this thing is going to be increasing?
This is one of the big worries, and right now, as some of the people who are opinion leaders in the field of Alzheimer's disease are trying to get the attention of our elected leaders in the states to consider, what are we going to do? We're facing this demographic time bomb. Right now, baby boomers taking care of their patients. This is just the beginning, and we cannot possibly cope with this. We're at a time now where we want to decrease budgets. We'd like to get the deficit under control. These are all laudable ideas, but we've got this problem of, oh my God, these people have to be cared for, and they can't possibly stay at home. This is just the way that the reality of the situation is. This is why the idea of a pill or a vaccine so very seductive. And I think that maybe, again, time will tell, but the idea that Alzheimer's will be eliminated, the problem will go away with a simple cure, and that has maybe led us to define the disease and attack the disease the way we have, this may not have served us well. That we may need to look at the brain failure as a consequence of normal aging, something that we can minimize but never eliminate. And
rather than looking for, you know, some way to help it in that respect, should the government not be more aggressive in trying to deal with this problem of how it can be dealt with? Because, like, I'll tell you my situation, and you know, I had a frustrating, you know, over 2 years of back and forth trying to get my father into a facility.
Go for it.
And when he was in the hospital, and you know, they re-diagnosed the situation, and when we approached the doctors at the hospital and said, look, you know, we think that my father may have had a miniature stroke and have that, you know, front lobe problem that may have caused part of the dementia, and they did do some, you know, CAT scans, and they did find out that was part of the case. We then try to see if we can put him in that facility based on, you know, the fact that, you know, he was pretty high, that he couldn't, you know, live on his own.
Well, I think you should add in here, Tom, that you were, not only were you busy with your business and your life and your own family, but you were going there every single day, looking after him and fitting that into your life now as sort of a new, you know.
Most definitely, you know, numerous times a day, never mind just once a day. But anyway, so the doctors, you know, would not sign any paperwork to say that, this person has to be, you know, put into a facility. Like, they avoided like the plague. And that to me was, like, ridiculous. because as soon as we brought him home, a week later, he took off in the middle of the night, you know, put a bag of his all his papers inside a bag and took off and went walking, fell numerous times, and this is in the middle of the night, like around 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. He lives in an apartment building, went down a park, bunch of streets, fell down somewhere, and somebody found him and called the ambulance. I got a call in the morning at 6 o'clock in the morning telling me, do you know where your father is? Going, wait a minute, he was home the last time I talked to him around 10 o'clock last night. Nope, he's in the hospital. Come and get him.
Did that instance change anything at that point?
No, it didn't change nothing to them, you see? And no matter how I tried with his doctor, many other doctors that you know, saw him, And this is the thing that really bothered me, like, to the extreme, that I had a test, you know, I was there during a test that one of the doctors had done. And to me, it was, like, so ridiculous, because what he did was he walked up to my father and said, hey, Peter, how are you? He goes, okay, hi. What's the day today, right? Now, there are times that, you know, he's very cognitive. He's fine, right? So as soon as he walked up to him and said, you know, what day is it today? And he said, you know, okay, Wednesday, whatever it was. And what's your name again, Peter? Excuse me, you're calling him Peter. I mean, he's not that stupid, you know? So,
and it may be that he wasn't having an episode.
Exactly, he wasn't having an episode at the time.
If I'm not mistaken, you can correct me if you like, Tyler, but these things sort of ebb and flow. You can have an episode, as it were, where they go and you know, want to pack a bag full of papers and walk down the street thinking they're going back to the old country or something. These things ebb and flow. I could be wrong. Maybe it's a steady state thing.
No. Particularly at the early state, they can have a bad moment, and then they're back. And just as sharp as they've ever been.
Yeah.
I mean, this is totally not news. Shouldn't be to the physician. I just find that baffling. It means, like, you know, I can understand if the money was coming out of his pocket. You know, if I put this guy in the home, well, it costs me money, but I just don't understand this at all.
The thing is, the government here, right, if you put him in a home, right, then they have to pay, you know, sometimes partial, sometimes more. So they try to avoid, you know, because otherwise you'd have to have, like, you know, a million facilities out there, because if this problem is growing, and I feel it is, because I know a lot of people that are dealing with it, then you have to have, you know, maybe 10 times the amount of facilities we have right now.
Yeah.
They can't possibly take care of them.
Yeah.
And this is just the beginning.
Yeah.
And this brings up to me sort of a philosophical sticky wicket, to get away from the medical stuff just for a second here. In many older communities, like European communities and the Native Americans, the thought of putting their elders in a place for somebody else who doesn't know them to look after them is abhorrent.
Yeah, it is.
They wouldn't even consider it. It doesn't even come into their consciousness. Now, that may be an antiquated way of thinking, or maybe they're just, you know, they have a different cultural outlook or something. But this is something that I had to struggle with before putting my mother into acquiescing to have my mother put into a institution for her to be looked after, an old age home, with care, with people looking after them. And I had to sort of go, well, you know, do you really, is this something, are you doing the best for them? I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's a philosophical sort of a thing, whether, I mean, are we just sort of sloughing our responsibility off onto other people? And like I say, in European and the Aboriginal communities and the Indian communities, they would never even consider doing something like that. Well, maybe they would if they were more modernized, but let's say the cultural outlook is different.
Probably the key question is, am I doing something of benefit? you know, just exactly what was going through your mind. And, if you think about it with Tom's dad, he could have very easily been severely injured, costing who knows what to make him right. So in terms of cost benefit, it clearly is beneficial to keep these people that need help in places where they can be safeguarded. I went through the same thing with my mom, and she did not want to leave her home, and I didn't blame her, but it got to the point where it was just unsafe for her to be at home.
Right. Were there any family members looking after her, helping, pitching in? Like no. I said, the European communities and they would just take it in stride and say, okay, I need to dedicate my X amount of time to my elder and help them with this.
Unlike Tom, there's only two kids in our family, and my sister's in Denver, and I'm in Phoenix, and my mom's in Iowa. So it's a hard day travel for any of us to get there. So it just wasn't possible. And if you can look in on them and you know, visit them, it's one thing, but it just was physically not possible for us.
Even myself, I mean, I'm only like 20, 25 minutes away from him, but, you know, I'm not there 24 hours to watch him. I mean, he lives in a building in the 7th floor. He could go and jump out.
Yes.
In fact, an individual, a friend of his in the building, did that exact thing. He lived on the 21st floor, and he jumped out about 2 months ago.
Yeah, it's the kind of situation you described where they get up and go at night is actually a very common finding, you know, that they wander, which exposes them to all kinds of dangers.
Yeah.
You know, an old person wandering around at night, well, my God, there's a target.
Yeah.
I assume Canada has some of the same crime problems that we do. I mean, boy, there's places that I wouldn't wander at night.
Right, right.
You can run into, you know, in the middle of the street, get hit, you get killed, and then what?
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe this is part of my thinking is the sort of the disintegration of the family unit. Your mother and father set aside 20 years of, you know, stuff they could be doing with their time, you know, going out to dinner parties and enjoying each other's company and stuff like that to look after you as a child. But as an adult, you don't put any time aside to look after your parents.
Yeah, I mean, some people do, but I think
I'm coming at it again. This not be personal. It's just a philosophical.
Things are changing, and it's you know, it's. But sometimes it's just not viable to be able to take care of a person that's you know, gone to a certain degree that, you know, you can't do. What are you going to do if you have to go to work, and you're going to leave them at home? You got the same problem as leaving them on their own.
Yes, it's as bad as having latchkey kids.
Yeah,
and you know, I mean, there's this constant worry, but that's the problem is that there are times when it's just unsafe. But yeah, Scott, you know, thinking about the idea of disintegration, I wouldn't say that as much as change. One of the things that we're coping with now is that so many of us are living longer than we ever have. And the biggest risk factor, bar none, for dementia, Alzheimer's disease in particular, is advanced age. And if you go back and you look a generation ago, actually the numbers are very interesting. 100 years ago, the average life expectancy was 49 years in the U.S. And now we're almost getting close to doubling that in 100 years.
Yeah.
This has had incredible changes foisted on society to deal with, you call it basically the aging population. And those things that Alzheimer's disease were relatively rare diagnoses 40, 50 years ago. We just didn't have the cohort of people surviving long enough. Social Security in the U.S., when they announced the retirement age 65, the average time of death was 61 and a half.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, they, you know, the payout was minimal. Now, my God, the economic fallout from having people live and draw everything they put into Social Security plus.
Plus, yeah.
Never anticipated. This wasn't supposed to happen.
And I think recently I was reading that, you know, they're anticipating that in the next 50 years, they're going to be able to bring the life expectancy up to maybe 150.
If everything went well and we were able to get rid of cardiac disease, cancer not so much because that's primarily at the end of life, but things that really hit and take out large chunks of what we consider vital years, so diabetes, cardiac disease, those things. Yeah, I've seen estimates that the kind of like the working span of a human body is 150, give or take a few years. My God, I can't even imagine what the debate over Social Security in this nation will look like.
And you know what? I don't really want to work for 100 years, so let's get that out there right away.
But I'm pretty sure nobody's going to let us be retired for 100 years.
Come on.
Draw a pension.
You know, what about being retired?
But the thing is, I can't even imagine what I mean, you know, even now, let's say, okay, if you make, you can make it to 100. My grandmother made it to over 100. And you know, what the lifestyle in the last, you know, 20, 25 years, it's terrible. Like, you know,
yes.
You're either, you know, confined to something or a bed or, you know, hospital and stuff like that. That's not exactly life, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So what the ultimate hope would be is that you have 100 years of vitality or reasonable quality of life.
And 50 in bedridden?
not be bedridden. So
I'm not a big fan of that.
No. I think what I was talking about, it is interesting that you mentioned change, because I would actually agree with that. Because in earlier times, people really didn't, what would it be, much earlier times, people didn't really spread out from the family unit. Until, I mean, like you said, one person lives in one city and the other one lives in another city, and you could have hundreds of miles between you. And when family units sort of stay together, they have the availability to look after their elders in an appropriate, because they don't really leave the area. Their mom lives, you know, two tents over.
Yeah,
right. So it's just a matter of moving mom from two tents over into your tent, and just another responsibility. She did the same thing when you were a child. She looked after you for 20 years, and then you moved two tents over.
Yeah.
Now it's just a reverse of it, but that's not, that sort of scenario is not viable nowadays. It's not, it just doesn't work. Our society has changed perhaps too much, and I'm not here to say whether it's for the better or the worse. That's not my point. My point is from a philosophical outlook, it's interesting.
And then just looking at, these are the realities we face now, what are the costs, and it's just staggering, absolutely staggering what could happen. One of the things that I would think we would be seeing more of, Michelle Obama has made childhood obesity one of the things that she would like to attack. And we've done some work on this, and I think it would be very helpful also to start sort of education campaigns to let people know that your lifestyle really does impact your future, and that we need to encourage people to stay active, to try to find ways to exercise, whatever their age. And this is all we have. This, the hard point to get across to people, they come to me and say, hey, how's that cure coming? And I go, well, yeah, another 25 years, I don't know.
Yeah.
We don't have many things we can do
our lifestyle. We can, like, tomorrow, Tom, I guess we're going jogging, right? We're good to go? Because usually I just jog into the kitchen, get a tea, and jog back out in the living room.
There you go. And so in addition to that, then you maybe want to do two trips to the living room.
Oh,
something.
You
know, we got to do something.
Well, yeah. you know what's funny? After when I had my heart attack and I was going to rehab, and there was about 15, 20 people there at the same time. And after, you know, going through all the exercise, all the things that we were doing that was supposed to have dropped my weight, I gained 3 pounds. So,
Yes, but it was 3 pounds of muscle.
Yeah, rippling muscle, no doubt.
I guess I was cheating a little.
I've got a six-pack. I just bury it under my belly.
So go we all. It's so much easier to do that than to try to combat it. When I was a kid in the 60s, President Kennedy had the President's Council on Physical Fitness because there were concerns that we were getting too soft, and this is the television age. You guys are probably too young to remember what happened when
I remember the
television hit. And that kind of has died. The physical fitness programs have been cut back, and Michelle Obama has been radically criticized for interfering in people's lifestyles. Dudes, you're concentrating on the wrong things. We really need to deal with this. Not fight about freedom of choice.
All it is some advice to get out and be more active. That's all. When we were young, we'd get home from school and say, bye, Mom, and we'd be out in running around and riding our bikes, and, our time to come in was when the lights went off. When the street lights went off, it was time for us to be in, and we'd be about an hour late, and we know we'd hear about it, but we didn't want to come in. We didn't want to come in and watch TV and stuff like that. We wanted to be out running around doing our thing, and that just doesn't happen right now. I can't say that. I'm not talking about the world in general now. I'm just talking specifically in maybe North America and America and Canada.
I'm afraid you're right. There's a very interesting book called The Last Child in the Woods, and that was the thesis, is that not only are we not, our kids not exercising and outside, we're becoming less and less environmentally conscious, knowledgeable. One reason that it's easy to destroy the environment is because so many people don't even realize its value. That book has been criticized because it's the demographic data to underpin it aren't there, but yet it's that anecdotal story where I go, I see that here in the neighborhood. I don't see kids outside.
No, you don't. Not that much. So, not that much. They're usually sitting in front of the TV playing the Xbox or on computers. Stuff like that. I mean, if you ask them about the forest, they'll tell you that they've seen it on the Lion King or something,
Yeah. Or they're afraid of it. It's kind of a scary place. You might get bit by mosquitoes, something.
No, I also have relatives that take their children camping all the time. One of my nephews takes his children camping all the time. Rafting, whatever, So that's great.
That's a great thing to do because everybody has to experience the outdoors a little bit here and there.
There must be strategies that we can adopt as a society that would encourage that. I remember when I was in grade school, one of the ways that the Kennedy plan was to have physical fitness tests, and then you get a gold star or a blue ribbon based on your performance, Kids work hard for some of those things. Maybe they did then. I don't know about now. But.
I was going to ask you, we were talking earlier, and you mentioned something called a brief history of the research. It was, what's the oldest old research?
Oh, well, I'm glad you reminded me of that. One of the things that Alex Rohar and I have been interested in are people who survive to very advanced ages who have no clinical evidence of dementia, not a trace, normal MMSEs, cognitive function intact, no problems. When they have died and come to autopsy, they're in our Willed Body program, for example, at Sun Health, and the neuropathologist has looked at some of these people, we've found that they have all of the hallmarks of Alzheimer's pathology. None of the dementia. And so our question, the first very simple question was in this group called the Oldest Old, what is it's different about their amyloid? Do they, store a different type of amyloid than the rest of us? Do they process it differently? Certainly looks the same, but biochemically we can really bore into this with mass spectrometry, get down to the absolute individual molecule level. And so we're asking those questions. Those data are coming in right now.
So what you're saying is that although they had the signs in their brains of the Alzheimer's symptoms, they did not have dementia, or they weren't showing any signs of Alzheimer's in life?
Absolutely correct. And the ones that we had at Sun Health just kind of fell into our lab, sort of an outgrowth of the Willed Body donation, the brain donation program. And we called them high pathology controls. Didn't know what to make of them. And I remember arguing with Alex since years back saying, man, those are key. You know, these guys are, they're the real thing. They're doing the right things biochemically. We need to know how they do that. And Alex, who's got many years of experience as an MD and in the Alzheimer's research field, said, no, Tyler, forget about that. High pathology controls, they were covering up. So one of the first things that happens early in the course of the disease is that people know something's wrong and they try to avoid being detected, or they won't do things that create problems for them.
Oh, okay. Now, you just said something there. They were covering up. Who was covering up what?
What Alex believed, and I understood his logic, is that the patients don't want to admit that they have a problem. Okay, now, this, you can see the problem. We are rationalizing somebody's behavior that we've never spoken to, never seen, never talked to. But Alex's idea of how you explained a high pathology control was somebody who was clever enough to know they were early in the course of the disease, but managed to evade detection, just didn't want to admit it, for example.
Okay.
Over the course of time. But that's a good rationale. Over the course of time, though, at the Oregon Health Studies Institute in Portland, they studied these patients that they called the oldest old, followed them very carefully, very thoroughly in life, and did postmortem exams on them. There's no question now, biochemically and cognitively, people who have all the pathological signs of Alzheimer's in their brain, but no cognitive impairment, do exist.
Okay, because so I was going to say, what you could do is you could track down their relatives and interview their relatives to see if there was, I mean, they could cover up for a test or two, but they wouldn't be able to hide it from their children, that's for darn sure.
Exactly. And it turns out that all those little facets, I believe, have been collected at Oregon. And so it's just a phenomenal sort of opportunity. And what we did is, what Alex and I proposed, is to get some of these very well-characterized patients and just look just square away at basically amyloid and a number of other molecules that might be centrally involved, and look for the differences. And we've got the pile of data on our desk right now, it gives you a headache to look at it. And that's what we're going through to present at the International Congress of Alzheimer's Disease in July.
Okay, where is that?
That'll be in Paris this year. So it should be a very expensive place to go. But this turns out to be one of the premier meetings that you want to go to. We're anticipating having our results discussed, but also seeing some of these big trials for the monoclonal antibodies, for example. Some of those data should be coming out, and we're very anxious to see those.
Okay, this leads into my next question. My next question would be, we've talked about the past of Alzheimer's, the history, some of the present research going on. What about the future? Where do you see, I'm sure this is a difficult question, but where do you see the future of Alzheimer's research?
What we'd like to do with Alex Rohrer's group is investigate the idea that vascular health is critical. And we've actually gotten, when people have come to autopsy, we've taken out their carotid arteries, for example, and looked to see how much of this amyloid they have in the plaques in there, and we've looked at the aortas and how healthy they are. But one of the ideas that we have, this is only an idea, it's just a hypothesis, is that really the key aspect to everything in terms of brain health is cardiac health. You got to keep that brain perfused. it can survive with the brain is a very oxygen and energy hungry entity. It probably takes 25% of all of the energy that you generate and a great deal of effort just to perfuse it. That right. brain can survive at a sort of a minimal level, but if you want it to function, you start thinking, boom, you start to see the activity go up. Glucose gets transported and energy begins to be basically transduced inside those cells. To meet those demands, you've got to have the circulation functioning. And we suspect that this is one of the first things that goes wrong in the brain is that the circulation begins to fail. The heart ages, for example, or amyloid starts to build up and starts this cascade of buildup and corrosion, okay. which basically ruins the vasculature.
What about oxygen? People with sleep apnea? You can wear that device on your mouth in when you go to sleep.
Yes.
If you've had a previous, say, for about a year, it's the damage is already done sort of thing.
And
I think I have sleep apnea because my wife always, sometimes she watches me as I stop breathing.
Yeah, it's like you're holding your breath. Yes.
Yeah, and then she goes, wake up!
And that can affect you at many levels.
Yeah.
Many levels in terms of your overall health. But, yeah, the apnea phenotype is very important for cardiac malfunction as well as cognitive malfunction. That it is not good.
Yeah, it can affect your short-term memory.
I'm a prime candidate then for Alzheimer's and dementia.
Absolutely. If you do have the tendency to kind of like hold your breath, is that what wakes her up, that you stop breathing?
Well, I'm not holding my breath intentionally.
Yes, yeah. There's a device called CPAP. That's what Scott was referring to, and that'll make you breathe a lot smoother. And it can make a big difference. You might get a decent night's sleep for the first time in quite a while.
Well, actually, the funny thing is, I don't have a problem with sleep.
Oh.
You know, that's the thing. Like, but maybe I stop breathing, or at least it seems that I stop breathing, you know, if somebody's watching me. But, you know, I don't notice it. You know, I sleep fine.
Yeah, okay. If somebody's telling you that you're waking them up, I would maybe mention that if you had a chance to...
Yeah, mention that to your doctor. You might be able to help you out with that.
Yeah.
And to be honest, Tom, who's to say that you don't already have brain damage?
I'm sure I have.
Well, I hate to tell you this, Scott, but it's pretty much inevitable for us. As I said, the leading problem or risk factor for Alzheimer's dementia is age. But as you age, around your 50s or so, you begin to notice changes in how you remember things and how you approach things.
I'm telling you, I know the last few years, I know it's declining fast.
Yeah.
Memory. When I say memory, like short-term memory. Not so much long-term memory, but short-term memory for sure. One of the other things I was going to ask about that was that as we grow older, right, and in cases where, you know, you have on higher ages like 90s and the 100s, you know, whereas people lose their short-term memory but have a very good long-term memory. Like, for instance, my grandmother, when she reached like close to 100, she wouldn't necessarily remember us, like as to, you know, what we are today, that she would think that we were like her brothers and stuff that when she was young. But she will be able to remember the language that she was born with, which she had forgotten, you know, as she got older. And now she became, like, excellent in the old language and couldn't remember the new language anymore that she was using.
This is actually one of the typical findings with Alzheimer's disease is the newer memories fade away. And the older core ones are accessed pretty reliably in those patients.
Now, can you explain why that is? Because it's sort of a weird thing. And I do know what Tom's talking about. They can remember stuff when they were 6 years old and tell you a story about how they were in the barn playing with their friends and they were jumping in the hayloft. And they can tell you the whole details of the day. but they can't remember your name.
Yes. One of the things that happens is as you get to this stage of, now this is the true dementia. These people are really descending now into the deeper depths of Alzheimer's. One of the most affected areas is a region called the hippocampus, which is deep inside, well kind of underneath most of the cortex. And that particular region is responsible, tasked with the idea of mapping out new memories. So something happens to you, it'll be held in working memory for a while, and the hippocampus will process it and then put it somewhere in the cortex. The hippocampus begins to fail. And at that point, you can no longer reliably form new memories. With Alzheimer's, as it goes on, the disease evolves from beyond that. Because if it was just simply, you know, 5-minute type memory, that would be one thing. But like Tom said, there's confusion about who he was, for example. The loss becomes progressive. And what actually happens is the cortex itself begins to be destroyed. And you can see this. The brain actually shrinks. Yeah. The volume decreases. It is just astonishing what happens. But the other thing that's quite interesting is that it's both gray and white matter that are involved. And the white matter is kind of like the wiring, the connection part. And it is heavily affected as well. And so that may also explain why you get these bizarre blocks, why language, the second language that's used, you think would be pretty deep in that person, why that's lost. But the old language, it's still accessible. And it could just be that the neural pathways have been cut, simply cut, and they're gone. They are gone.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
But it's we think that one of the things that the neurologists have done well is they've mapped structure and function, and the things that we see in terms of the evidence, like the story that Tom had here, are consistent with the pathology, and that we believe that we understand what these cells do and what the consequences are of their loss. There have been some very spectacular instances of people who have had damage. Just a few months ago, a man passed away who had a lobotomy many years ago to stop epilepsy, I believe. And what they did is they severed his hippocampus. And that poor guy was a smart person, but he was completely trapped in the now. He could form no new memories.
Really?
The memories he had were there, but nothing new. And one of the people who studied him for decades, mentioned that he thinks at the end of many years of coming in and talking to him, quizzing him, seeing how it was going, he thinks that the guy finally got the idea of who this scientist was. But, yeah, so that the destruction of the hippocampus, that's it for your short term.
Wow, okay. That's very interesting.
One of the other things I was going to ask now, when somebody's diagnosed with dementia or Alzheimer's, what type of treatment are they given?
Okay, one of the first things that you can do for those patients is to try to ameliorate the problems is you can give them drugs like Aricept, which will inhibit an enzyme that destroys basically a signaling compound in the brain, and it'll make their neurons communicate better, that the signals will be stronger in their brains for a while. There's another one called Namenda that actually inhibits a receptor for another class of signaling molecule in the brain, and it makes that molecule persist longer than it would otherwise. And so they seem to function better for a while. It can make a big difference. It's only temporary. And ultimately, the disease is relentless, and it will. There won't be any neurons to fix in the end. They will, as we said, the brain shrinks, the neurons die. But when they're still there and still functioning, Aricept, Namenda, some of these other agents can make a big difference in their ability to function. And
in their day-to-day, in their day-to-day lives, yeah.
Yes, and it can last a year or two, longer in some instances. It, you know, like all medications, they have some side effects. It makes some people very jittery. Some people can't take it. Like my mom is so little that they'd have to be very careful with a dose with her, probably send her to the moon.
You know what I find is that a lot of these doctors nowadays, they tend to give, instead of maybe drugs of that nature, you know, they give them like lorazepams and things that, you know, just keep them calm.
Yes.
But that doesn't really solve anything.
But no, the side effects of lorazepam can be devastating, yeah.
You know, the other thing is that in some instances, too, things like serotonin uptake, re-inhibitors, all those things, if the patient's depressed, might be a little bit helpful. But, there's even Aricept and Namenda are not really doing anything but staving off the inevitable. That's where we are at the moment.
Right.
But, you do wonder.
Like my father, like, you know, he's right now he's up to like sometimes 6 or 7 or 8, you know, these, I don't know, maybe 1 milligram of lorazepam a day. And really, you know, he's not really helping anything because he still acts pretty much the same. And he does have, you know, these episodes every so often.
Yeah.
There are times where he'll have the episodes maybe once a month, sometimes more. And there are other times where, you know, he can go 3-4 months and doesn't have any. You know, it's very weird.
I guess that's why I was asking about the future Alzheimer's research, because right now we're, you know, doing just trying to help them with the symptoms, as it were.
Yes.
Not eliminating the problem, which is where we hopefully eventually want to get to, but like you said, it's a very tough nut to crack, isn't it?
But some of these herbs and things that, or even drugs that open up vessels and, you know, give more oxygen to the brain, that sort of thing. Has that been helpful at all?
People are considering some of these issues, and one of the problems, but we've focused very intensely on the amyloid cascade hypothesis as the central explanatory factor for Alzheimer's disease. And things that have talked about or people who have focused on the vessels are considered rather, let's just say, archaic. That was the old explanation, the hardening of the arteries. And so we kind of passed that by. It's kind of hard at this stage to get a lot of people who have worked very hard on amyloid biochemistry to come back around and say, you know, maybe there's something to this vascular issue. Let's try something like Viagra, you know, and open the brain up here. It's not in favor. I'll just not put too fine a point on it. It really is not in favor right now.
Are side benefits to Viagra as well.
Well, how about Cialis? You know, something. Anyway, one of the problems that we've faced in Alex's group is when we've worked with or tried to talk about published studies about the vasculature and its relationship to Alzheimer's disease, it's been hard to find an audience. And the AD people who study biochemistry don't understand us. The guys that do a lot of the vascular work don't care about AD, and never the twain shall meet. So we're at a stage now where we're at the real soul-searching stage. You know, what's next? Partly we will continue. We'll try to knock down tau. But part of it, I think, finally, is going to be, well, let's talk about the vasculature. And so that's what we're in our lab are hoping that maybe we now can kind of push this forward a little bit. There's a group of scientists that have a website. It's called Prevent Alzheimer's Disease 2020. And this group, led by Zavin Khachaturian, are very interested in formulating new paradigms to approach what are we going to do with Alzheimer's? What's our next move? And they're trying to investigate these ideas like the vasculature, like an interaction of amyloid and circulation.
So are they looking at alternative cures?
They are thinking that all comers here are being considered.
So like natural cures, naturopathic cures and this sort of stuff, they're looking at that as well?
If I had to guess, I'll just tell you, Scott, probably not. Yeah. And the reason that I'd say that is I'd have to actually look at the people who were on the panel. That's not heavily favored by what I would call the more traditional people. And one of the problems with these study groups is that you get the usual suspects. What I believe that Dr. Khachaturian will do ultimately, though, is ensure that more alternative voices are heard, and that that there will be a way to get messages and concerns to them. One thing you could do is review their website and say, hey, did you think about this? And I believe that Dr. Khachaturian is really at the cutting edge of basically the new effort, and that he, this is just personal opinion, is determined to cast off, you know, the whatever it is that we find it doesn't work for us, and substitute in something new and see how it fares. So this is an exciting time for people that might have different ideas, because what we're doing now isn't getting us anywhere. I mean, I shouldn't say that, but it hasn't gotten us where we want to go. Right. Plan B. We could use Plan B.
Yeah, well, I mean, like that Eastern fella who brought in the studies, he's doing actual studies with mice, so it's interesting that he brought that up.
And he was, guy had a great idea, and he had lab data for it. This is a great start.
Yeah.
There's been
a lot of alternative. I mean, Mary Toko, who we've had on our show, she has she has her own radio show, and she has doctors on her show every week talking about alternative health and alternative healing and stuff like that. And these are doctors. They have MD in front of their name, you know, after their name. So it's not just, you know, wacky people living in trailers staring at the sky. You know?
Well, one of the things is that you do have to guard against knowing everything. As an expert, I think that the quip is that, you know, you'll immediately see all the things that won't work. And somebody who's maybe not so tied into the actual accepted knowledge might be just the one who says the thing that leads to the next breakthrough.
Well, I found, I work with mycologists, and I find that the researchers that are, you know, are very specialized in a specific area. You know, sometimes they find the problems, but a lot of times the amateurs that are more generalist, not so close to, you know, in a pigeonhole type way, you know, they come up with solving problems much faster.
I hate to say this, Tom, but you've pretty much encapsulated Alex Roher's theory. As an MD, he feels that one of the things that's been severely lacking in Alzheimer's disease is a global view of the problem. And that's why he got interested in the vasculature and how he started to come
into
contact.
It's great that he's open enough to do that sort of thing. That it means he's a unique individual.
And there are others out there. To be very blunt, the Alzheimer's field is loaded with talent. But as Tom said, they tend to be guys like me. They're hyper-specialized, focused on amyloid. And I can tell you a whole lot about amyloid, but in terms of how the body functions and circulation, I never would have thought of that. Right. The reason I'm involved with that is because I work with this guy named Alex, and he knew that you're going nowhere if your brain isn't perfused.
Yeah.
And something as a biochemist, wouldn't have considered, you know, I wouldn't even thought about it, wouldn't be interested in it. And that's part of our problem, is we're so balkanized, so siloized, that it's possibly impeding us. And this is where I hope that Dr. Khachaturian can break that. And I feel like they're determined to come forward with new ideas. This is a good move.
Do you have their website?
It's Prevent Alzheimer's Disease 2020. I think it's just www.pad2020.org. But if you just search, I think, Prevent Alzheimer's Disease 2020, I think you'll find it. And just by way of disclosure, I have no financial contact or association with Dr. Khachaturian or this group. I am actually a contributing member. I donate money to them. because I believe in their cause. But you know, I'm not compensated in any way. This is my belief. So, and I'm very excited by the prospect of what I think they're going to accomplish.
Now, is there anything that can slow down the progression of this?
There is not. Once it appears, once the signs of impairment appear, it does indeed seem that all we can do is let the patients function a little bit better with, they're not palliatives, but things like Aricept. And then nature will ultimately take its course. For those of us that don't have the impairments, the best thing that we can do is to stay active, stay cognitively engaged, stay interested, exercise, eat right. That's it. That's where we are. And it's not very satisfying.
Well, it's like in my observation, at least, and then again, this is only my opinion, but I find that individuals that, you know, have a lot of mental exercise, let's call it, people that, you know, read a lot, or they play games, or they do whatever, you know, functions that get the brain working, compared to individuals that, you know, just kind of sit around and do nothing, or sleep, or whatever, it goes much slower than, you know, if somebody is not doing anything.
Absolutely. That is absolutely borne out by the data. And this is one of the best things that you can do. You know, I look at somebody like Bill Burns, UFO hunters, probably added 50 years to my life by his TV show. Because I get so engaged and exercised and upset.
It makes you think. You
know? It makes me think and all that stuff. So God love him.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you for bringing that up, because I wanted to just ask you if there was, you were a previous guest on our show, you were with Carol Rainey, and we were talking about the co-creation of the abduction phenomena. I was going to ask you, was there any follow-up after that? I mean, what happened? We knew what you were asking for and what you were talking about, but it's been a couple months now. Has there been anything that's happened since then?
There have been responses. Bud Hopkins has issued a response to Carol's article. Really nothing directed towards me and the science aspect that I brought up. A number of people have commented on websites and whatnot, and it's split down to camps that either feel that the alien abduction phenomenon, as reported by David Jacobs, Bud Hopkins, and others, is gospel. Or not. And in terms of my scientific colleagues, they were disinterested before, and they are disinterested now.
Did you get any contacts out of it? Did you?
I did. I got through UFO updates. I got some really good responses from some very intelligent people asking good questions, and very heartening, because it confirmed to me what I suspected, is that there really were a lot of people sincerely interested out there, good thinkers, you know, not necessarily the sort of people you would think are nuts by any means. These are intelligent, capable people, and they're interested, and they would like answers, and capable of going back and forth in a reasoned debate. And so that made me feel very good.
Yeah, and just to refresh, you were coming on to basically offer your services as a lab person to study any materials or that would come out from an abduction case. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I've done some work, not in abduction cases, but for other investigators in the past. One of the problems that we would have is, for example, with Dr. Jacobs, he would have some difficulties at our institution because of how we define research and how we actually do human studies, human subject studies. For others, it's something we could look at. I do have to follow the Institutional Review Board rules and regulations at my institution, and I would follow them to the letter. And that requires certain documentation issues and approvals.
Of course.
But If we could manage that within the confines of the NIH guidelines, which we follow at our institution, yeah, I would definitely like to contribute if that was at all possible. Yeah, I certainly would be willing to advise people in terms of not actually necessarily having to do the hands-on, but saying, you know, look, you could do DNA analysis on this, and here's a company that could help you, that kind of thing.
All right.
So far, no go on the abduction stuff.
Okay. Well, just so our listeners know, if you're listening and hearing about Alzheimer's and wondering why we're talking about UFOs now, we're a multidimensional show, and Tyler Kochjohn is a multidimensional man.
Okay.
All right. It was great talking to you, and we'll try to, yeah, keep us up to date. I mean, if you guys discover anything that's, you know, you need to get out there, send it to me. I'll put it up in the news section. If you do have anything you would consider a singular great article on what your foundation is doing in regards to Alzheimer's research, send it to me. I'll throw it in the news section.
Okay. The other thing I'll do is when we get back from the meeting in July, end of July, if there's anything really hot, I'll let you know what came out. They do have press conferences and whatnot, so you might see it before I even get back.
Yeah, but, if you get something, just forward it to me, and I'll throw it up in the news section for sure.
We're looking forward to the data. There should be some studies coming to completion on passive vaccinations and some of the data. Hopefully those will be available. And
I mean, we're all very interested because we're well part of this problem, you know, and we need to, you know, get involved.
There's a lot of people out there very interested in this because we have parents that are affected with this. This is an issue that's a close to home thing.
Not to mention, chances are that we're going to have one of the same problem.
Well, you know, this, in a nutshell, that's one of the driving forces, I think, that has to come together to get basically our elected leaders to make sure that the resources are there for research and studies. We are coming to a very difficult time in terms of demographics here. And many people, Zavin Kachaturian, Dr. Zavin Kachaturian, very concerned about what the future holds. And hopefully people like you and others that are interested will support.
And whether there's going to be money available for that research.
And, you know, the other thing is in the interim, for my money, I'd just like to see more things like Michelle Obama coming out and saying, this is important for everybody's future, a healthy lifestyle. And benefits are incalculable. Once you go down the path of cognitive dysfunction, you're not coming back. And so to prevent that.
It's a preventative thing. It's a big deal because, yeah, we are going there.
And we could do so much education at so little cost, and I feel like we're overlooking that, or maybe haven't considered it, that we just have focused too much on we're going to have a pill, we're going to have a vaccine.
Yeah, we're going to fix this, we're going to beat this.
Is there any associations that are pursuing the governments to deal with this problem?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's one that is associated with the ICAB meetings called iSTART, and what I-S-A-R-R-T, I think is how it's spelled. The International Congress on Alzheimer's Disease has a website. If you just search ICAD 2011, they'll have the iSTART information there too. And what they're trying to do is create a cadre of scientist activists and get those people to increase public awareness, but also to increase awareness amongst our elective officials. And that primarily has been focused at the professional community. I think it's time to go further. I mean, a lot of good things happened against HIV/AIDS because the gay community became incensed at the situation and began to agitate for help and concern and treatment. And the problem is there's lots of worthy causes, But this one is, I personally feel, is one that we simply can't ignore anymore. We've got to do something.
We'll see you guys next week.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.